one has to really feel inside oneself whether it's the calling and this time to do the medicine. Ayahuasca is for everyone, but not everyone is for ayahuasca. In other words, you need to have a certain level of personal development to even come to meet this medicine. It's a tertiary experience. It's not for beginners. And if you still think that things out there in the world are causing you to feel the way you are, then probably better to use a modality that is a bit softer until you start to understand that you are responsible for everything. If you can take responsibility for your own feelings, thoughts, and emotions, then you're probably ready for ayahuasca.
Welcome to Salish Wolf, a podcast bringing you inspirational stories of extraordinary endeavors. I am your host, Todd Howard. Just south of my Vancouver Island home is a tiny archipelago on which for nearly a decade lived a most astonishing animal, a lone wolf. Takea, as he would be named, survived and thrived in an environment where likely no wolf had ever set foot. In the process, he captured the hearts of a community and showed us even the most unlikely is possible. His story is not dissimilar to those of the individuals interviewed on this podcast. At some point, they each had to turn to their inner lone wolf. From there, they were able to lead and inspire. My intention is to share their journeys to help you discover your own inner greatness and peace. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor Point Expeditions, where I provide life-changing personal leadership retreats for men, coaching, and other valuable personal growth resources. Visit anchorpointexpeditions.com to see where your journey could take you. If this episode had a subtitle, it could be Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Ayahuasca Without Taking It, and then a whole bunch more. Based in a beautiful rainforest oasis in Byron Bay, Australia, Darpan has been co-creating with ayahuasca for nearly 30 years, having mentored under some of the most renowned psychonauts of modern times, including Terence McKenna and Stanislav Grof. Darpan has held ayahuasca ceremonies for thousands of individuals committed to a deeper connection to spirit. This is the first of two parts of a mind-blowing and heart-opening conversation, and each part is dripping with the nectar of psychoactive plants and the teachings they offer. After pursuing formal university studies in psychology, Darpan then went into theater and acting for a dozen years and began his real psychological education in situ from the stage. What he learned about people and himself helped give him gifts that he would later use as a guide during countless plant medicine ceremonies. Darpan lays out copious information, including the history and chemistry of ayahuasca, indigenous healing practices, variations on plant healing ceremonies, and his experimental research with the healing powers of the acacia tree. He also talks about personal preparations that can be advantageous prior to ceremonies, such as a traditional diet and deep personal growth work. His careless hero's journey one night with LSD makes for an astounding tale and carved into his psyche a deep lesson that he never forgot. Darpan is a beautiful man with profound connection to the healing powers of our planet and also the healing powers that lie, sometimes dormant, awaiting the right catalyst within each of us. Please enjoy this episode of Salish Wolf with Darpan. Darpan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining me, and thanks to our mutual friend, Dan Reed, for connecting us.
Indeed.
He's certain we're going to have a wonderful conversation, and I'm excited about it. So pretty much everything I know about you comes from Dan, either in our conversations together or in reading his memoir. So I'm going to start with what he introduced me to you with, which was his first experience with ayahuasca.
That's correct.
In a ceremony that you led in Byron Bay. And from what I've gathered over my conversations with him, you have quite a lot of experience with ayahuasca. So lately, it seems I've had a lot of guests on the show talking about psychedelics. That has not been intentional for the most part, but let's just run with that theme. So let's start with that. Tell me about your experience with ayahuasca and any of the other psychoactive plant medicines that perhaps you have experience with.
Well, Todd, it's been a lifelong association. I took my first mushrooms when I was about 18. I was at university, I was studying psychology, and it was a profound experience. In fact, you know, that sort of hyperspatial realms that it introduced me to, felt very much at home. Even at that age, I was just really like, yes, I know this and I want to explore this. Even though there's a lot of controversy around psychedelics at that time, because, you know, I entered university in 1972. So that was just on the tail end of the whole psychedelic revolution as it happened in America and elsewhere in the West. And so, like, I was very, very interested as a young man in these kind of developments, even though, as I say, there was a lot of controversy and a lot of misinformation at the time, you know, around psychedelics. I mean, there was a lot of misinformation on the level of, like, you know, if you took LSD, you'd jump out of windows, you'd look into the sun and go blind, it'd give you deformed children because it changes your genetic code, and a lot of other, you know, nonsense, really. But, you know, my own experience was telling me, yes, this is good. This is really, really beneficial for me. And so I was at odds with the information that I was receiving around all of this. And yet I chose to trust my own experience. And you know, I became more and more interested in not just the psychedelic realm, but particularly with the plant medicines. And at the time, I remember I had a Datura plant growing in my backyard. And I realized that it was, you know, having read Don Juan, that it was the Castaneda books, it was also very psychoactive. But intuitively, I felt that this plant was not for me. I was interested in checking out all other plants, but somehow on an intuition level, I just raised my hand and said, thank you, I honor you, I respect you, but you're not my ally. You know, and since then I've had them around me. Even now, as I look out the window, there's Brugmansia and Datura growing everywhere, and they're wonderful protector spirits, I've found, but they're not my ally. And so I have them around, but it's the one plant that I've never felt compelled to explore. And I think it's a very good reason. I think that, you know, you're born sometimes with gifts in this world, you know, like a great artist, or, you know, Mozart writing concertos when he was 3 years old. You bring certain tendencies and gifts, if you like, from past life, at least this is my belief system, you know, achievements. You don't take your body, but you can take your consciousness and any developments or characteristics that you may have developed in a particular life. And I feel that I've had, you know, a strong experiences with these plants in past lives. And that's why I felt such an affinity and a kinship and a kind of a familiarity with them right from the word go. And then someone introduced me to LSD, and which is not a plant form, but I had an amazing affinity with that at a young age too. And, you know, I only ever took these plants and these substances in really sacred contexts, like generally with one or two or three other people in a beautiful field or in nature somehow, and we would take it together, not speak very much and just really stay silent and tune into nature and tune into each other, and generally always playing music because I'm a musician and it's been a lifelong study of mine and a lifelong joy, I might say. And so from a very young age, I was introduced to these medicines and to the psychedelic realm. And I continued, I then, you know, after I finished my degree, I did an honors degree in psychology at Flinders University. But then I fell in love with an actress and spent the next 12 years in the theater, studying theater and being an actor, doing Shakespeare and, you know, doing comedy and tragedy. And I must say, interestingly enough, that I learned more about psychology in those 12 years in the theater than I ever did at university. The university studies were useful in that they gave me a good academic and intellectual understanding of the realm, but my real experience of psychology came through the interaction with theater, with other actors who you became very intensely involved with in the rehearsal process, the performance itself, reaching people, the whole notion of, you know, in the theater, there's all kinds of crazy people working in the theater. So you not only got to meet these wonderful expressions of the different polarities of human expression of consciousness, but you got to play them as well on stage. So to me, it was a very, very formative and very educational period, my period as an actor. Then I had my daughter and I could no longer dedicate myself to the kind of vocation of being an actor, which involved rehearsing by day and performing at night for very little money, really. So then I had to change my tactic and I went more into film and television, which paid me much more money for much less work. And that was also an interesting thing too. All the while I was always playing music. So I had bands, particularly rock and roll bands in the 80s, a number of different bands, St. Vitus Dance, Die Laughing. I played in the Divinals for a while, you know, things like that. And all of these different career objectives like acting, music, were all going on at various stages of my development. But the one constant thing that permeated all of that was regular psychedelic intake. And I never looked at that as a vocation, nor did I look at it as a study. I looked at it as a merely recreational activity that was allowing me to explore my deep innermost and my own interiority. And I loved it for that reason, but I never at any time saw it as a career potential or as a choice to create a way of life out of that. Or, you know, at that stage, that was just, you know, that wouldn't even have occurred to me, you know. The idea of being a shaman, for example, I mean, that was just, what's that? You know, it was just wasn't there. And yet I must say, it was there with me all the time. And when I found ayahuasca, I think it was in a roundabout, I met a guy called Terence McKenna. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, Terence was the one who introduced me to the medicine. We brought him to Australia to do a series of lectures in the late 90s. And although I had started, you know, my own academic interest study of ayahuasca around about 94, 95, and because Australia grows a lot of acacias, which is a very rich source of DMT, and which is an admixture to the brew when you make it, which is made from at least two plants. That's generally the vine, ayahuasca vine, and the admixture of the DMT-containing plant, which is usually, you know, Psychotria viridis, otherwise known as chacruna, or acacia, or any other DMT source. And it can vary from country to country, particularly in South America. So anyway, Terence, we brought him over to do these series of lectures, and it was wonderful to meet this man who was like my, you know, a kind of an academic guide and mentor. I'd read all of his books and I loved, he was such a brilliant raconteur and storyteller. And of course he didn't fail to impress us when he came into our crew, our little tribe here in Byron Bay, because we wrote to him and said, would you like to come to Byron Bay? And we thought he's probably way too busy. You know, he's a very well-known man. But he said, no, I'd be delighted to. What, the land of the acacias? How could I refuse? So before we knew it, he was here in our midst. And he was staying at my house, and we forged a very deep friendship, which continued until he left the body. And so we were always in contact after that. But anyway, I was saying to him, look, I really would like to get access to this medicine. And so he checked me out to see how I was and everything. We took some DMT together. And then he said, okay, great. He said, I can supply you with that. And I went, how wonderful. And so he would go back to Hawaii where he lived and then send me these little brown boxes, which had these little brown bottles in them, and the little brown bottles would have various markings on them. Some of them said, you know, what he called standard dose or heroic dose. You know, of course I was taking the heroic doses. And for 2 years, I was able to self-initiate. I had the access to this medicine, which was, you know, unheard of to be able to get it unless you went to South America. So I was very fortunate to have him as my very first maestro, who provided me with the medicine, who was the initiating agent to put me on this path that I've been walking for the last 28 years. And so I have to thank Terence for his incredible gift to the world, for his largesse, his generosity of spirit, his incredible intellect, and his amazing research and the ability to put that across in a very heartful way. The guy was a genius. He really was. I mean, in his presence, he'd just laugh and, you know, smoke joints and have fun. But what was coming out of his mouth was just, as you know, just incredible. And so it was a total inspiration for me and for us, our tribe here, that, to have his presence here. And so that began my research with ayahuasca. That after about 2 years, I got this message from the medicine saying, I'd read all the literature that if you really feel called by this medicine, then you need to subject yourself to what's known as a dieta. And so, like, I was feeling very called. I'd read all of the literature. So I put myself under the strict conditions of a dieta, which means no sex, eating very, very plain food, no salt, no sugar, no spices, for a period of about 3 months. And I was drinking every day or every second day during that period of 3 months and had in contact with only one other person. And that began my career with ayahuasca. And that was a profound immersion. Those 3 months is where it all happened. That's where I got most of my downloads. And that's where I got the inspiration to devote my life to the work of this medicine.
Incredible. And just to clarify for listeners who aren't aware, when you were drinking every other day, you were drinking the medicine, you were drinking ayahuasca.
I was, whilst maintaining the strict conditions of you know, eating only rice, basically, right, and some plantains.
What a story. And talk about hitting the jackpot on mentors. He's like one of the godfathers of psychedelics. And that is incredible.
Yes.
Incredible. A lot of things here that you just said that I want to talk about, but I want to step back to your days in the theater. You said it was more educational to you than any of your studies in psychology. And I'm curious what you learned about yourself during that time.
Good question. Thank you. Well, you know, just let me put it this way to give a bit of perspective, and then we'll go into the theater. Everything that happened prior to me coming across ayahuasca, now I look back, it's so obvious, I couldn't see it then, was a playground or an education for me to do the work that I'm doing now. Because with my degree in psychology, with my work as an actor and my work as a musician, I had all these different hats. I'd be a therapist one day, a musician the other way, and then I'd be doing my acting work, but I sort of felt a little bit, you know, schizophrenic, or what do you call it, triphenic, I don't know. You know, I never really saw myself as any one of those things. If people said, are you an actor? I said, well, that's what I'm doing right now. I kind of enjoy it. But I always had this sense that there was something else waiting for me, but I had no idea what. Once the medicine found me and called me, now it's obvious. I look back in all that period, that first sort of 30 years of playing ground in those disciplines was just training ground, because all of that experience that I gained in those years all came together under one umbrella once I worked with ayahuasca. Because you're working with ayahuasca, you're working with a multidimensional psychodynamic tool par excellence, and you're dealing with, you know, the psychic, the spiritual, the emotional, the mental, and the physical. So it's more than an allopathic doctor who deals just with the physical. You need a lot of training on multi-levels, multi-dimensional levels. And because of all my training since 18, I've been doing all those psychedelics all that time. I must have taken literally hundreds and hundreds of LSD trips in that time. And I never, ever had a really bad experience. It was always positive for me, even when it was a kind of a challenging, I'd been in many challenging situations, but it was always a lesson. It was always a positive aspect to most of the journeys that I took with LSD. But once I found ayahuasca, I stopped all work with LSD or anything that came out of the laboratory. I was working in the beginning periods with LSD and ayahuasca, but I had an experience where ayahuasca wrapped my knuckles and really, really kicked my butt, but saying, you do not work with another teacher while you're working with me. And I got that message loud and clear and fully respected that, because when she booted me in the butt, I can tell you it was a boot in the butt and I thought I was going to die. So then I realized this is a real teacher. This is a teacher has my best interests at heart, and she just wants my total and focus and attention. I thought, fair enough, because I do trust this medicine. I went, okay, I'm yours. I'm going to stop doing any other medicines for a period of time. Anyway, for the period of time that I was being instructed by the medicine, by the ayahuasca. And that's what I did, you know. So she is a very, very demanding teacher, loving, but very clear and firm as well, you know.
When she booted you in the butt and you said you thought you were going to die, what was that experience?
Oh, dear, that's a story, I tell you. That is a deep story. Okay, I'll go into it, but it's going to take a little while. But, okay, at that time, I was involved with the dance scene. And we were doing, like, dance parties in the bush, bush doofs and stuff, and it was beautiful energy. It was maybe 200 or 300 people coming together, setting up teepees, chai shops, dance floor, in nature, in the forest, and then we're in lasers and lights, big sound system, and we just danced all night. As medicine, and we'd all be taking LSD, and it was a very beautiful, pure situation. Some years later, when the backpackers and there was alcohol came into the story and cocaine, it all fell apart. But at this particular time, it was really beautiful, juicy tribe of people doing amazing events with full sacred intent. And so I was about to go to one of those parties, And a friend of mine had been making, gee, I don't know if I should be saying this on air, LSD, and had left a Petri dish on the table. And I'd gone to bed at around about 9 o'clock, thinking I'll get a few hours sleep before the all-night dance party. And when I came back down from the from sleep, I saw the Petri dish there, and I just thought, oh, I'll take some LSD. I licked it, and I thought, God, I wonder how much that was. I thought, that's okay. I'm used to high, heavy doses. It's all right. And once I got into the car, already there was a sign saying, don't go anywhere. My car got a blowout in the tire. But then I jumped into my girl, a friend's car, and they started driving me towards the party. And about half an hour later, I just felt completely weird and all of this sort of like intense energy. I was just like I was being stuck inside of a dark crystal. And I started wanting to throw up. And I'd never thrown up on LSD before, ever, in all those years of taking it. And I thought to myself, how much was in that Petri dish? And then I realized it was the pure, pure, pure before it had been diluted to put into the other. And I would have taken something in the order of 20,000 mics.
Oh.
I know. That's, you know, when you think that most people take 100 mics, and most people, and a really strong dose is 250 mics. And I'd taken regularly up to 700, even up to 1500 mics, which is deep, deep, deep. And I was doing that with blindfolds and headphones, because another teacher of mine was Dr. Stanislav Grof. And I was doing it. And I'd worked with him, and I was doing it according to his message. Anyway, that's another story. But I thought to myself, my God, I've inadvertently overdosed myself on LSD. And I was dry retching, like the body was trying to get it out of me. And I said to this woman who was with me, who I couldn't see, I said, I'm dying. I said, I've inadvertently poisoned myself. Please lay me down and stay with me. And she said, should I take you to the hospital? I said, no, no, no. I said, just stay with me. And she was doing all these Mahakari mantras all over me. And I could hear her voice coming from the far distance, even though her face was probably right next to mine. I couldn't see anything. It was just darkness. Normally with LSD, you're seeing things. I could just see black. And I was freaking out. I thought, I've died a psychological death with LSD many, many times. I was not afraid of the death experience. But this time I thought, my God, I'm actually physically dying. And this is the big one. And so I had to really prepare myself for that. And in the midst of that, I got this definite flash of ayahuasca coming in with a stern face going, you do not work with another teacher while you're working with me. I could feel this energy. I was going, oh my God, I've blown it with the ayahuasca. Anyway, so I said, just lay me down. And then eventually my girlfriend came with another car, bundled me into her car, took me back to my house. And for the entire night, they stayed with me, these three angels. And I was just in the darkest, darkest state of birth perinatal matricy too. I don't know if you're familiar with Stanislav Grof's map of psychedelic space, but it's the hell space. It's the space where this will never end. I honestly thought I've lost my mind and it was never going to come back, you know, and I had these weird palpitations in my heart. And around about dawn, when I was thinking I'm permanently damaged, this thing happened. Suddenly I was just like birthed into this ecstatic state. It was like, and that was BPM 4, which is Stanislav Grof's map goes, BPM 1 is heaven, BPM 2 is hell, BPM 3 is transformation, and BPM 4 is rebirth. That involves both coming from hell to heaven. And that's the state that I was in. And as I was being rebirthed from this incredibly ecstatic state, it was as if I'd just taken, you know, a normal dose about an hour ago and was just coming on to that. And so I said to the girls, I checked myself. I thought, actually, I'm fine. My heart's fine. My brain's fine. I was amazed to discover that I was actually okay. And so I said to the girls, let's go back to the party. And they said, what? I said, yes, I feel wonderful. And they said, and this is after 8 hours of this, of just being in this darkness. And so they took me to the party, went into nature, went to the waterfalls. It was fantastic. But 2 or 3 days later, the walls were still moving and the carpets were still moving, you know. It was that strong. But eventually it wore off. And I, in that stage of coming down, I got the distinct message that ayahuasca had set that up for me. the whole thing, because I'm so careful about dosage. I'm extremely careful about these things, having had so much experience. And it's very unlike me to just lick a Petri dish. But somehow in my, just coming out of my sleep, I did that. And I think that the ayahuasca compelled me to do that because she knew I was still taking LSD. And did it in a way that was both a blessing and a curse. It was to say, do not use this other medicines while you're working with me. And the second thing was, I think it was Friedrich Nietzsche who once said, anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so having gone through that experience of going to that depth of that state, of that really, really constricted, restriction of that hell state, and coming back from it, gave me the ability to, whenever anybody's in, I've come across people since who've been in that state at festivals and things like that, and I've been able to go right in there with them and pull them back out of that. So it was not only a big kick in the butt, but it was the greatest gift, because she gave me a gift of like having experienced that level of chaos and coming back, so that I can now go there. I can go there at will with people, like, you know, for bringing back souls or you know, like, you know, soul retrieval, or which is basically what it is. It was the greatest gift. So having survived it, I am very grateful for that experience, but I wouldn't wish it upon anybody. It was intense to the max. But that was, after that time, I didn't take any more LSD. And I devoted myself entirely to ayahuasca. And that was 28 years ago.
So with a dose roughly 200 times size, the normal dose.
Yeah.
I presume you told your friend about this who manufactured the batch. Oh, yeah. What did he have to say about it?
I should never have left that there. You know, like, oh my God, yeah. But I can tell you how it goes. With LSD, you have a graph, and the graph goes up. It increases as you take 200, 300, 400, 500, 600. But when you get to 1,500, it doesn't get any stronger. It just levels out. And then what I took was way in excess of that. And how my body mind responded to that was just to kind of switch off. It was just overloaded. And it was switched off up until that point, 8 hours later, where it was able to come down to a level or to a kind of a concentration in my body or whatever the process happened, that it allowed me then to be rebirthed into a heavenly state that was unspeakably beautiful and beyond words. And it was a beautiful counterpoint and balance to those 8 hours that I'd gone through prior to that, which is the most hellish experience I've ever been through in my life.
Well, as you said earlier too, LSD and some of these other substances have been very controversial, continue to be very controversial, but you just took a 200 times dose of an average dose and you survived it. And really, I think that goes to demonstrate how safe something like LSD is, because it would be very hard to actually kill yourself on it, as you demonstrated.
Right. In fact, if I'll go into these statistics, the Bureau of Statistics in the government here, and they're looking at all the deaths from various substances, and, you know, so many thousand from tobacco, so many thousand from alcohol, from, you know, sleeping tablets, from this, that, heroin. And then psychedelics, it came none, zero. There are zero recorded deaths. So one could say that the psychedelics are demonstrably way more safer than the socially sanctioned substances like tobacco and alcohol.
Of course. I don't know if there's any substance that you could ingest 200 times the normal dose and actually survive it. Even water. If you were to drink 200 liters of water, you'd probably die.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, like, I felt the experience was that I was going to die. Mm-hmm. But actually I didn't, which was a fortunate thing.
Do you think physically you were actually on the brink of death, or do you think it was more of the psychological death that was happening?
It was psychological. Yeah. Although psychologically, I thought it was physical as well.
Yeah.
Because as I said earlier, I'd been through that psychological death with LSD many, many times before. So I trusted that process. But this time it was so dark and so deep, and I went, you know, completely blind, that I thought that I was physically dying. I actually believed I was physically dying. So it was the single most powerful teaching experience that I've ever had in my life. As I said, it was on many levels, and on the most basic level, it was the medicine really booting me in the bum. And then on the other level, it was an amazing boon on the level that it's having survived that. And I have come across other clients and other people in random situations who I recognize that they were in that space from similar overdoses, and able to assist, able to help, able to go into that zone with them and help them come back.
Right. We also hear often with these substances, LSD in particular, that the addictive nature of it is so high that just one dose of it and you're going to become addicted to it. And here you had been using LSD for years. You took this superhero's dose and you quit cold turkey after that. Did you have any sort of withdrawal symptoms?
No, absolutely none. The only thing I had, which was directly due to the shock that my body mind went through from such an overdose, was I had a slight kind of like heart arrhythmia. Like my heart would go boom, 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 boom. And that happened for 3 months and then it dissipated. But that was because it was like having that experience was like having a head on collision with a Mack truck, right, psychically speaking. And that disappeared too, but there was absolutely no withdrawal symptoms or any desire to take it or any kind of like, you know, pathological condition that was a direct result of stopping taking LSD. No, absolutely no. I can say categorically, it is completely non-addictive.
Mm. I just recently read the autobiography of Dr. Carey Mullis. He's the inventor of the PCR, polymerase chain reaction. His autobiography is incredible, Dancing Naked in the Minefield. And as a chemist, and being a chemist who was fond of LSD, he also used to try to create versions of, and he once created some sort of substance that he thought would be similar to LSD, and he took it, and he had an experience that almost exactly mirrors what you just said, including a car ride from hell. And he thought he was dying. He thought he was absolutely gone, and it lasted, to my memory, a similar amount of time that what your experience lasted. And then he came out the other end fine.
Well, it just goes to show how lucky someone like Dr. Albert Hoffman was when he was working with that lysergide in the laboratory. And then he had that famous bicycle ride home where he started to trip on the LSD. You know, you familiar with that story?
Yeah.
Well, he just happened to get exactly the right dose. Through his fingers, he got about 250 mics. So he was really, really lucky in the sense that he could enjoy that. Had he taken more like I did, or like this other doctor, guy who invented the PCR test, he probably just got the wrong dosage. You know, I don't know what his substance was that he was making.
Yeah, I don't know if he did either even, but yeah.
Dosage is everything. But he's an interesting man himself because he stands by his PCR thing, but he was said that it should never be used for diagnosis.
No, never for medical diagnosis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, his book, for anyone who's listening, I wrote a book review on it on my website. It's a very powerful story, and he questioned everything. He never took anything for face value, and he was questioning things back in the 90s that are still controversial today. He was questioning the climate change propaganda. He was questioning HIV as the cause of AIDS. He would definitely be questioning, in my opinion, COVID and all the propaganda related to it. He was just that type of guy who took nothing for granted. And even if it was in the scientific journals, such as HIV is the cause of AIDS, he wanted to be able to go in and repeat the experiments and confirm for himself. And ultimately what he found with HIV is there were no experiments. There was nothing that could be repeated. Anyway, that's another side trail. But
sadly, he's no longer with us. Perhaps the whole PCR testing thing wouldn't be happening if he was alive today.
Yes, and there's a lot of controversy around that death that happened 4 months before COVID. Anyway, I digress. Back to the experience. I had one other question, at least, but you said ayahuasca came in. Mother Ayahuasca came to you during this experience. Did you still have ayahuasca in your system? Had you?
I did.
You did. Okay.
I did. Yes. Because I'd been using the ayahuasca really, really, you know, I was researching it. So I was using it, as I said, every second day, you know, out during that period of the dieta. And even after, I would be doing it irregularly, you know, like at least once a week. And certainly I had it still in my system when I took the LSD, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's what I could feel. I could feel, you know, it's just one of those things, when you know it, you just know it. You just like this, I just could feel what she, her disapproval. And I could feel her presence in my body. And I could feel that she was, I didn't see it as a lesson at the time, which it really was in the end. I just could feel her booting me. Big time, like really going, no way, no, you do not use another teacher while you're working with me. Because she had really taken me on as a serious, you know, student, if you like, disciple. And yeah. She was entirely in her rights to do that.
Now, I've worked with ayahuasca. I know a lot of people who have been working with it for years and years. In your experience, is there a... Is there a point of potentially over seeking with ayahuasca, overdoing it, over drinking, overtaking the medicine?
I do think so. Like with anything, I think there's a way of abusing it, and there's a way of using any substance or anything in this three-dimensional plane. It always has a light side and a dark side. And ayahuasca definitely has a dark side. I think that in the current situation in the West, like I was pretty much one of the people who pioneered the spread of ayahuasca throughout the Western world, because when I started to give sessions, because at the end of that 3-month period, the medicine said to me, now you can give this, share this with other people. And for many, many years, I did no more than 4 or 5 people. But then it gradually grew when I was doing weekly groups of about 20 people here in Byron Bay. And then it came to a point where I started traveling, and I met a guy called Carioca from Brazil, who ended up being one of my teachers as well, a beautiful shaman from Brazil who came from the Santo Daime tradition. And so up until then, I'd been mainly doing the sessions in the dark. I was doing it in the jungle style. But then I opened up to this beautiful communal kind of way of doing the medicine with the Santo Daime. I found the Santo Daime a little restrictive in the way in its conceptual framework, but I fully honored it and fully honored every tradition in ayahuasca. Whenever I go to a Santo Daime, I totally abide by the rules and regulations of that particular ritual ceremony.
Can you explain a bit how it differs or is similar?
Okay. In the jungle, it's very much a personal journey. It's very much an inward journey. It's in the dark. The shaman sings Icaros to guide and invoke various energies. But it's pretty much a personal journey. Like you're in your own interiority. You're aware that other people around you have also taken it, but you can't see them. You don't know what they're going through, except for perhaps on a telepathic level, you can feel what's happening. But with the Santo Daime ritual, it's a very different ritual. That was done more, it was set up by a guy called Maestro Irineo, who was a 6'7" black man, a rubber man, rubber tapper. And he was working in Acre in Brazil, and he was drinking with the indigenous people there. And he had this vision of what he called Divina Mai, or the Virgin Mother. And this Divina Mai said, you must start a church, and you're going to hold this space, and you're going to sing. And he said, I can't sing, you know, like, what do you mean? And she said, yes, you can. And here's your first song. And she channeled down this song called El Canto Nas Alturas. El Canto Nas Alturas, a minha maica. It's a beautiful song, which I generally open up all my ceremonies with. I love Maestro Irineo. And so he set up this situation where it was more like he wanted it to be accepted within the Brazilian tradition. So they kind of adopted a quasi-Christian, or let's say an eclectic mix of Christianity, animism, and a little bit of Umbanda from Africa, you know, nature spirits and the kind of voodoo, if you like, which is a form of, Umbanda is a form of voodoo. And it's a mix of those things. And And so they started to set up a situation where it was done in light, it was done in bright light. They were dancing into a kind of, they have this sort of dance, this hypnotic dance that they do, which keeps everybody together. And everybody sings, not just the shaman, but everybody sings. And they all have songbooks in their hand, doing this little shuffle dance. And in bright white light, often in just fluoro light, which I find a little bit too much, but that's how it's often done. And you're in the midst of the medicine journey, singing, holding the book. So it's not really much chance to sort of go deep into your own interiority. And I thought to myself, wow, that's a really different way of doing it. And I was totally open. I wasn't judging it. But then I got what was going on there, that they were really creating a congregation effect, and they were working more from the heart to create or to do what they call the trabajo, the work. So in other words, they see the work, the dance, the singing as a way of working the energy to create beneficial effects in everybody in who's participating, and then to telegraph that out to the wider community. And I found it a very beautiful way, because you were very aware of the group, whereas within the jungle style you weren't. And it was very beautiful, that communion, like a holy communion. So when I then had taken that influence and had worked with karaoke for a number of years, and then started my own way, which was somewhere in between the jungle style and the Santo Daime, because the Santo Daime do have a lot of rules, like you can't cross your legs, you've got to sit up straight in a certain way, you've got to be a certain way. And there's a lot of what I find peripheral rules and regulations which are useful to their ceremony, but not essential to the ayahuasca process. It's just something they've adopted to do, and I fully honor that. But I'd felt that for the generation and the people that I was working with, that was a little bit old school. Like, you got to remember, Maestro Irineo lived in the early part of the 20th century. And he was also bringing Christianity into the story so that he could become accepted by the government as a bona fide religion. So there were other political reasons as to why they were doing that as well. But I still saw the beauty of it. So in my sessions, I use candles, just a few candles, not fluoro lights. But so you can still see the community. You're still aware of everybody in the circle. And I do use dressing in white as a part of my ritual, not because it's an essential aspect of ayahuasca, it's not, but just to create an energy field, which is also what the Santo Daime do. And I really like that energy. That's just that everyone's wearing white, it creates a beautiful feeling in the room. So I took that aspect of it. But a lot of the jungle aspect, I would say to people, look, if you want to journey within, just put a blindfold on, or bring some of those eye shades, or just simply close your eyes, and you could then have that experience of going inwards, but also being aware of the sangha, the community, outwards. And a lot of the work that inspires my or a lot of the intention, the main intention that inspires my work, is the creation of conscious community. That's my vision of bringing ayahuasca into the world, and that's how I use it. Some people use it to heal, some people use it to do harm, some people can use it even for warfare. You can use, depending upon your intention, ayahuasca can be used in many different ways, because ayahuasca itself is not an entity as such, as we often call it, the mother. It's a portal into the hyperspatial realms, into what you might call the astral realms or the fourth dimensional plane. And as such, it's just a portal. And so once you open that portal, the songs and the prayers and the ikaros determine which of the spirits or which of the aspects of that fourth dimensional astral plane you are bringing down into 3D space-time reality. And that's where the shaman is crucial in holding that space. And the shaman is also a watchdog to make sure no unwanted spirits are coming through that portal who could perhaps disrupt or in some way, create an altercation within the ceremony, which does happen, and many ceremonies can be very chaotic as a result of that happening. So for me, it was very much a marriage of those two traditions, and now I hold it in a space which is low light. I use ikaros, I use guitar, like also Western, like devotional music from various devotional traditions around the world. It might be Tibetan, Indian, Portuguese, might be Spanish, English, Hebrew, whatever the traditions that carry that frequency of that mystical, devotional kind of prayer is what we use in ayahuasca as well. So it's a kind of an eclectic thing from my part as well, where I'm using sections of the Santo Daime, certainly being informed by the jungle traditions, but then bringing in also the mystical traditions of around the world. And I found this to be a very, very effective way. And although I was fully trained by my teacher, Don Jose Campos, which I met later in Peru, and I did lots of dietas with him, and I studied the ways of curanderismo, which is the mestizo Indian way of doing ayahuasca, where they use it to heal sick people. But my teacher said, you know, when you work with ayahuasca, you've got to make a decision. You have to make a decision whether you're doing this work to as a way of consciousness expansion, or whether you're going to heal sick people, like people with cancers, tumors, you know, that kind of thing. My teacher was very much in that latter category. He was a healer. He was worked with, he turned around so many, conditions, health conditions that were, you know, virtually going to be fatal to the people, and turned them around. And I've seen that again and again. But for me, when he said that, it was absolutely immediately clear that my function and my intention of working with ayahuasca was because I want to work with healthy people and open them up to multidimensional awareness. And so that's how I started the work. And when we started the work, it was early days, and it was really beautiful. The people were coming, were like really sincere, on the path. But then you got to that stage, which is still there now, which is where ayahuasca has become a bit of a fad. And then people come because, oh, you've done doing ayahuasca? Oh, yeah. And it's sort of like a sort of an eclectic social group. And that's where I think that it can be overused. It's like, you know, one has to really feel inside oneself whether it's the calling and this time to do the medicine. I never persuade people to do the medicine just because we're running a session. I say, if you have the calling, if now is the time, then please come. But if not, then totally fine. I never try to be an evangelist or try and persuade people, because one of my sayings is that ayahuasca is for everyone, but not everyone is for ayahuasca. In other words, you need to have a certain level of personal development to even come to meet this medicine. It's a tertiary experience. It's not for beginners. And if you still think that things out there in the world, situations, people, events, are causing you to feel the way you are, then probably better to use a modality that is a bit softer, like rebirthing or holotropic breathwork, until you start to understand that you are responsible for everything. That, you know, how you feel, what you think, and how you act, and your deeds are coming from a place of responsibility. If you can take responsibility for your own feelings, thoughts, and emotions, then you're probably ready for ayahuasca. I'm not saying that's a condition of pretext that you have to do that. I mean, many people aren't in that state and quickly do come to that state, but it's really good. There are many people who are simply not ready for ayahuasca. And in that case, I always reserve the right to refuse a person to come. And I just say, look, it's not for you, because I don't think that it's for everybody. It's really a tertiary experience. And even for those people who are coming to finally answer your question, I think that there is a limit. One needs to really check in with oneself and see the truth of whether now is the time to drink. Generally, if it's truly your path, then drink as much as you like, and it will go deeper and deeper and deeper. I've been drinking for 28 years, at least once a week, if not three times a week, because often I'm running week-long retreats. And I can say that there's been no harmful effect, no deleterious effect whatsoever. And if I was to stop it tomorrow, it'd be just like when I stopped LSD. There would be no withdrawals, no side effects, no yearning, no craving, none of that. And in fact, if I wasn't giving it to people, as I still do, I probably would stop drinking it. And I'll tell you why. Because ayahuasca works on the frontal lobes of the brain. And they've done a lot of biofeedback experiments with Tibetan monks who are meditating, and people who've taken ayahuasca, and others who've taken psychedelics, and it's all happening in the frontal lobe. And what I feel ayahuasca is doing is opening up these neural pathways in the frontal lobes, awakening that part of the brain which has been predominantly dormant in most people up until now. And our next evolutionary push is opening up that frontal lobe of our brain. And I think that ayahuasca does that impeccably. And it's not that you become dependent upon the ayahuasca in order to do that. It's not like, oh, I need to drink ayahuasca to open up those pathways again. No, Once you open up those pathways by repeated immersions with ayahuasca, they remain open. You don't become dependent or reliant upon the teacher or upon ayahuasca itself. Unlike other drugs, you know, like that's why I say it's not a drug. And, you know, to another proof of why it's not a drug is because I've taken lots of drugs and I've found that over time you need more and more and more of whatever drug you're taking because your tolerance to it lifts. Well, with ayahuasca, it's exactly the opposite. Where I was taking heroic doses in the days of McKenna 28 years ago, now I need to take just a little bit and I'm in exactly the same place. So I can take less and less and less, which is exactly the opposite of what happens with a drug. So what you're dealing with here is not a drug. It's a psychoactive plant, and you're interfacing with plant intelligence, just as I'm interfacing with you now. As you know, you've taken it. So I don't need to tell you, but just for the benefit of the viewers, it's a relationship. It's a synergy. It's not just, oh, let's see what the drug will do. If I give you MDMA, I can predict exactly what's going to happen for you. But with ayahuasca, I cannot, because you are the most important ingredient in the mix between ayahuasca and any particular individual. That mindset, the biorhythmic place where that person is, how they're feeling, totally determines the nature of the session or the experience that will be had, more so than the substance itself. Because I've taken the same amount of ayahuasca of the same brew on different days and had entirely different experiences. So to complete, to sum up, I think that, you know, it can be overused. And so one needs to come with respect, because you're dealing with an intelligence, you know, just as you are. And you don't abuse that intelligence by taking it for granted or by treating it flippantly. One needs to have great respect with this medicine. And so that respect entails only coming to the medicine when you're sincerely ready and open to receive her.
That was an incredible discourse on ayahuasca. Thank you for that. I am most impressed too that you kept the original question in mind and you kept coming back to it after I took us off on that tangent with the Santo Daimai. And thank you for telling us about them and sharing that experience as well. So much there, Darpan. Wow. In your 28 years of drinking ayahuasca, are you at a point, do you ever get to a point where you can start to predict or expect a certain experience, or is it different every time for you still?
I would never be that so arrogant. I have had stages in my development where I thought exactly that. Oh yes, now I'm on top of this. I know what's going to happen. I'm on top of this, you know. And then she'll just whack you, you know, like just to show you playfully that you just don't know anything yet. And so it's a very humbling experience over a long period of time to meet this medicine, because I can honestly say after 28 years of very intensive work, I have no idea how she works. None whatsoever. You know, my mind can think it has ideas and theories and concepts about how she works, but I can tell you it's a mystery. And I want it to remain a mystery, because this is not a problem or something to be solved or worked out. It's a mystery to be lived and bowed down to, because it's a gift of consciousness from the plant world to human beings. It interfaces so seamlessly with the human nervous system, you know, because we already have these same alkaloids endogenous within our own body-mind system. The pineal gland has pinealine, which is virtually analogous to harmaline, which is in the ayahuasca. We have DMT. We have 5-MeO-DMT. So you've got a rich cocktail of ayahuasca in the pineal, which is normally reserved for the moment that we die, or when we have a near-death experience, or for orgasm sometimes, like samadhi, satori. These rich cocktails are released in those moments. And they can be induced to be released, as I say, like with near-death experiences and stuff like that. But generally, they are left intact within the pineal, because it would be too much for them to be released in day-to-day life. However, ayahuasca exactly mirrors those alcaloids. So there's an innate resonance. It's like the key fits exactly, leaving no side effects, no toxicity, no habituation, no addiction whatsoever. This is pretty extraordinary. And really, the usage of this divine medicine goes back into the pre-dawn of history. We really don't know how long it's been used, but there's evidence that it's been used in the mystery schools of Sumeria, of Egypt, of the Mithraic mystery schools in Persia, and in the Sufi cults, in the Gnostic cults. But it wasn't called ayahuasca there. That was in the Middle East. It was called Hauma or other names as well. But it was using different plants which contain exactly the same alkaloids. So you have the jungle version from the forest, which involves, you know, Banisteriopsis carpi and Psychotria viridis, the two plants that are used there. And in the ancient mystery schools of the Middle East, you have Peganum Hamala, which is known as Syrian rue, and you have acacia. Acacia nilotica grew prolifically all through Egypt. And Osiris, one of the main deities of Egypt, was synonymous with the acacia tree. That was his symbol. And there already you have the association. So they used the combination of these acacias and Peganum Hamala in the Middle East. And I believe this was a throwback from the ancient days of Soma in the ancient Vedic days, where they use, no one really knows what Soma was made of. And you're familiar with the idea of Soma, yeah? And just for the viewers, it's an ancient sacrament that was used, you know, 5 to 10,000 years ago in the Indus Valley. And it was actually presided over by a god called Indra. And no one knows what it was, but you know, I have my theories about that because I believe it was an ayahuasca brew. Because if you read the ancient Upanishads, which are basically songs of praise and poetry to Soma, they read just like the Santo Daime Hinarios, you know, the hymns and the praises and the Icaros that we see today in the Santo Daime and in the various indigenous ayahuasca cults in South America, all have the same flavor, the same feeling. And one could easily imagine that phonetically, Soma became Hauma when it traveled from North India down into the Middle East. So I believe that this ayahuasca spirit has been with us for a long time and not just from the South American Amazon basin.
And where you are in Australia, of course, such an ancient traditional culture there and one that is very much entrenched in medicine and plant journeys. Was acacia being used there by the indigenous for ceremonies that you're aware
undoubtedly,
of?
Undoubtedly, without any doubt, yes, it was. How it was used is a mystery, because we have this tragic situation in this country whereby, you know, the white people, well, we decimated the Aboriginal culture. It's really genocide. I won't mince words. What was happened here in Australia was genocide. And although many, you know, people remain that are mixed between white and the ancient Aboriginals, very few full-blood Aboriginals left. There are some, and they may well maintain these secrets. I don't know. But when about in the 20th century, they had this thing where they had this thing called stolen generations, not really written up in the history books. All the massacres are not written up in the history books. But we know about the stolen generation where they took the children away from their parents and took them away from their dreaming lands and put them into Catholic or Christian missions where they were separated from the culture. And you have to understand that the Aboriginal culture was an oral tradition. Nothing was ever written down. It was passed down in stories from elder to initiate. It was passed down for 50,000 years in an unbroken line, these mysteries, all the knowledge of the plants and the animals and the way to keep and sing the land together. They were incredible custodians of this land for all that period of time, 50,000 years. I mean, look what's happened here after just 200 years of white colonization. It's like a cancer has come across this land with all the cities and the, you know what I mean? I'm not putting it down, but from an Aboriginal perspective, it must look like cancer. And anyway, they had this unbroken oral tradition, which was broken by the stolen generation, because the children were separated from their parents, the parents were separated from their tribal lands and their dreaming space. What did they do? Alcohol did the rest. It just decimated them. And when I was first interested in acacias in relation to ayahuasca, I went to a guy called Uncle Eric in the Bundjalung Nation, who was the elder of the Bundjalung Nation here in Byron Bay. And I talked to him and, you know, hung out with him a while. And you know, I asked him about the traditions with Acacia and what they were. And he said, look, he said, you want to know the truth? And I said, yes. And he said, that information died with the old fellas. In other words, all the old Gudaicha, the medicine men, the shamans, it died with them. They didn't pass on that information. So suddenly 50,000 years of unbroken, you know, oral tradition is stopped. And now, of course, the Aboriginal people that remain are no longer privy to that. And so they're trying to reorganize their culture through dance, art, and things like that. But medicine has been lost. There are so many trees and so many herbs that they would have known about that we now have to laboriously rediscover. And it'll take, you know, generations to do, because the ancient rainforest up in the northern part of Australia is part of Gondwana, the most ancient rainforest on this planet. So there are trees and plants and herbs there that don't exist in the Amazon or in other jungle areas. But the fact that they were associated with ayahuasca is absolutely true. He said, yes, there was, but he wasn't privy to that information. But, you know, the very fact that the acacia is called, it has a name. Well, I'm just escaping me right now. Anyway, the name that you give the acacia is the same name that the medicine man had. So there was already a direct connection. And when you go to any of the sacred sites here in Australia, if you have an eye that knows, I always look around and I go, there they are, there's the trees. They're just always growing in these sacred sites. Whether or not they planted them there or whether they made the site sacred because they were there, I don't know. But there's a direct connection between the medicine men and these acacias. In fact, they believed that the Gudaicha, which was the name that given to the clever men or the medicine men of the Aboriginal nation, would jump into the acacia tree after they died. Their spirit would go back into the tree. So there are a lot of anecdotal and kind of correspondences that point to the fact that they were definitely used. But, you know, Uncle Eric did give me a bit of a hint. He said that he thought that they would make a paste out of the acacia trees, and that they would put this paste around their neck and also around their genitals, probably where the lymph glands are, or, you know, so that it would be taken inside through the skin. So that's perhaps one way, but I have no doubt that it could also have been a brew that they made, because their acacias are incredible. They're like nature's laboratory. Some acacias make just 5-MeO-DMT, others make DMT, others make DMT with other tryptamines like monomethyltryptamine, 5-MeO-DMT, NMT, bufotenine. So you literally get a cocktail of tryptamines in some of these plants. And others do beta carbolines, which is the same ones that you find in ayahuasca vine. In other words, you could take that acacia and this acacia, join them up and have a brew. And even more amazing, we've recently found a tree that contains exactly both in the right concentrations. You have the right amount of beta-carboline alkaloids, which is harmal, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmaline, which make up that family of beta-carbolines, which are normally found in Syrian rue or the ayahuasca vine. And you've got the DMT together in the same acacia. This is incredible. So all they would have had to do was just take the leaves of that plant, boil it up, and you'd have an ayahuasca brew. So these acacias, 98% of which all live in Australia, are nature's laboratories, and they mimic or mirror our own inner chemistry of the body and of the neurotransmitters we carry endogenously. So this is incredible, and much, much more research needs to be done, because the research that we've done is purely underground. Like myself and a bunch of others have come up with about 10 different acacias that are active in terms of carrying DMT, as I said, with various concentrations and various mixes of various tryptamines. Some are absolutely pure DMT, others are not. But there's so much research to be done. And this is all information that the Aboriginal people would have had. Those old clever men, they would have known this. And now we have to laboriously rediscover this. And I would despair at times when I would go, oh my God, that incredible wealth of that cornucopia of information is just lost, gone. All those years, thousands of years of accumulation, gone. And I would despair and I'd get really upset about it. But once I started to drink the acacia tree, and it's a drink that we now in Australia, amongst my group, we call it Soma Acacia. This is the brew that we call the ayahuasca made from the acacia tree. We call it Soma Acacia to differentiate it from ayahuasca. And when I started drinking the Soma Acacia, then I went, oh my God, it's not lost. What goes around comes around. Within those trees, within the Akashic information that is contained in those trees is everything. So it's there, and it's now available to not just to clever men and Gedaicha, but to anybody who cares to drink it, no matter what their race, no matter what their skin color, no matter what their cultural attenuation. So it's very fortunate that we have these trees coming back into vogue and to focus, because they are a mystery school unto themselves, and they require a really deep study. And, you know, the study that myself and my friends who discovered these trees here, you know, literally 25 years ago, is just underground. We're doing underground research, and it's been very, very valuable. And we're doing very hands-on practical work with it. But it would be great for a study, you know, a scientific study to be done of, or an ethnobotanical study to be done of all of this information. And I'm sure that will happen in time. But we've been very, very fortunate to be at the receiving end of these incredible teachers just right now. You know, in a kind of underground, unofficial kind of way, you know, but the full power of those mysteries is available. It doesn't matter whether it's an official study or not. So in that sense, we've been very blessed and very fortunate.
Yes. Wow. I want to go back to the genocide you speak of, and you're not alone in Australia. Canada is the same. And today, I won't even say coincidentally, because I don't think there are coincidences, but today in Canada is a day of listening. And basically it's a day for us to listen to our First Nations elders and hear their stories of the atrocities that they went through in what are known as our residential schools and our Indian hospitals. And on my podcast, I think last year it was, I interviewed a good friend of mine, Joan Morris, who's an elder of the First Nations who survived that experience. And her tale, her story is, it's heart-wrenching. It's incredibly heart-wrenching to listen to. And she's one of 150,000 who went through that experience. And as you said, that when you take the kids away from their parents en masse and you put them in these Catholicized schools and hospitals and you beat their traditions out of them, it does put a full stop to the traditions. And there is no longer that thread that can connect through, because if they survive that experience, life is a very different place than it was before that. They've been completely detached from their ancestors. And as you said, alcohol is unfortunately one of the things that gets turned to. So it's, I just want to acknowledge that today in Canada is that day to listen, a day of listening. And very much the same as what you've told about Australia. It's really, it's terrible. And I also want, in the same note, I want to recognize, you spoke of ethnobotany, I want to recognize some of the people who are dedicating their lives to preserving the knowledge before it is completely lost of these plant medicines. A good friend of mine, ethnobotanist Nancy Turner, Wade Davis, an amazing ethnobotanist who's doing incredible work, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass. There are these people who are immersing themselves within the indigenous cultures, and they are preserving the knowledge. And I just want to acknowledge them and the work they're doing, because it's essential. And the same goes to you. I want to acknowledge the work that you're doing and the research that you're doing to help bring forth the knowledge of acacias, which, as you said, it was never lost, but we have to go forth now and rediscover it. And on that note, can you talk a bit about the research? Are you doing any sort of systematized research in laboratories? Is it more of in situ experiences with the plant medicines? How's that going? What's that look like?
Well, firstly, I want to say I hope that the fact that Canada's made a day where they can honor Indigenous peoples and the kind of rich experience and the kind of tragic situations they had to endure. So that's wonderful that Canada is at least doing that. And that's a very, very good thing.
Yeah. I do want to acknowledge, If I'm not mistaken, well, I know it's being heavily promoted by Gord Downie's foundation. Gord Downie, who was the lead singer of the Tragically Hip, an incredibly iconic band here in Canada. And so he passed away a few years ago, brain cancer. But his foundation is, I believe, behind this day of listening. So I just want to acknowledge that. It's not the government. I'm pretty sure the government is, not supporting
the government. Wow, that's really progressive, because the Australian government will not do that. We've been trying to get them to say sorry, but they won't do it, because it means that then they'll be open to all kinds of reparations and, you know, like people need to be compensated. And so they will not do it. And there's been so much pressure upon the government for them to do that.
It's the same here. And from what I can tell, they're not doing anything. They're basically whitewashing it all. So trying to make it disappear. So it's events like today that are really grassroots events. Again, I don't know the full history behind it, but it seems like it's a grassroots event that is coming forward. And it's on the heels of the discovery of over 200 bodies in a mass grave in a residential school. And that happened, the discovery happened very recently, and those were all children in the residential schools back in, well, I don't know the exact date of it, but those were First Nations children who died in residential schools, and that mass grave was just recently discovered. So this is this sprang forth from that tragedy, that terrible tragedy. Anyway, back to you.
Very, very good. Okay, so to the question, in a simple word, no, we haven't done any systematized scientific work. No, that's not my role. And that's why I say I really feel that somebody needs to step in and do that. But what we have done is create in situ situations, as you mentioned, where we're very experiential. We're experimenting upon ourselves with the plants liberally. And in that area, we have, myself and some friends who are also part of this have an immense wealth of experience. Like literally, you know, the 25 years that we've done have been fully exploring the acacias, researching their habitats, researching all the alkaloids that exist within each one. And it's really hard to find this information. We've been using a resource from the CSIRO, which is like a research institute in Australia, which has done a considerable amount of work, bioassaying, no, not bioassaying, but just registering and testing a lot of these acacias. But I guess for us, it's been more on the level of like utilization of these tools, and in a very, in a context which is mystical. I mean, I'm more of a mystic than I am a scientist, and I really applaud the scientists, because there has to be people who record these things. But for me, I'm the researcher, and the researcher is very much on a personal and shared level, because my interest is not is more in the transformation of consciousness than it is in the recording or the research level, the R&D, if you like, of the work. And yet I do have friends who are doing a lot of R&D. And, and fantastic that they are. And I would say that a lot of, I'm working with these people, although they're not, again, scientists, I do have friends who are systematically researching these acacias, and we cross-fertilize with each other. So I'm the more hands-on experiential aspect of it, like the utilization of the tools. And my other friends are more like the researching, going into the jungle, into the forest, and just exploring and discovering these different acacias and what their various attributes are. And as I said, they vary widely. And some of them are not active at all, but they all have some sort of medicinal use, I would say. And that's why I say it's a very rich area potentially for any ethnobotanist to really get into, to explore. But our research has been pretty much in situ, as you say, and we've had amazing results, like incredible. Like, it's still a well-kept secret here in Australia. In my tours to Europe, when I was doing work in Europe, I did sometimes take some of the somacacia there for people to use and to check out, and it was always spectacular results. But pretty much, I don't know many people using it besides myself. You know, I know a few other people and they're all around here. But around the world, I have, yeah, I've given it to a couple of people in UK and they're using a kind of a Korean variant of the acacia to produce the same results. But all the acacias are different. So you need to get to know every tree. And I spent the last 25 years really developing relationships with these trees. So I treat these trees like I treat you. It's a person, it's a being. I'm interfacing with a being. So it's not just I'm a scientist observing the characteristics and measuring the qualities and characteristics of the tree. I'm treating the tree as a sentient being. And so like when I harvest from trees, I always go to the same trees because I've developed a relationship with those trees. And you know, I've discovered also that they are very habitat specific. So the trees that are growing up on the hill might have different concentrations of the alkaloids than the ones down in the valley. And so for me, it's really important to be exacting dosage when I'm giving it to other people. So by becoming allies or friends with particular trees, not just grabbing them at random, I get to know exactly their concentrations and I get to develop a relationship with that tree specifically. And it is a relationship. And the more that I think that you hone or fine tune or calibrate your consciousness to these living beings, these sentient beings, the more they come and assist you. It's a symbiosis, which is a different kind of a symbiosis than if you were just studying them as a scientist. And that's been my particular area of focus. So I haven't really concerned myself with the kind of disciplines and the kind of of scientific research, basically. And yet I totally applaud anybody who's ready to come and do that. Yeah, but my relationship to it has been far more subjective. Therefore, it's hard to quantify or reproduce in a kind of an objective way, but I intend to write a book. I'm just about to start to write a book where I can give of my experiences and give a kind of an impression of the depth of that kind of a relationship once you develop it with the plant intelligence itself. But it is by its very nature a very subjective one and one that has to be experienced, to be known. It's not like you can describe it, as I will in my book, but it really is requires you to take that step into direct communication to really understand what I'll be talking about in the book. And you know, certainly scientific research can be very useful in terms of, you know, concentrations of alkaloids, what other alkaloids are present, you know, characteristics of the tree, things like that. I think is absolutely important, but that has not been my role.
Well, that's so cool. You're basically, from what I can tell, you're getting plant information from the plants, which of course is what indigenous cultures have done because they didn't have the bioassays. They didn't have the scientific experiments. They didn't know what was going on in the laboratory because none of that existed. So in your experience, during some of your revisions with acacia or with any of your psychoactive or healing plants, are you getting additional plant medicine information during those quests? Like, is Mother Acacia speaking to you and saying, this other tree actually is going to give you what you're looking for in this area?
I haven't had that specific direction, but I'm sure that it could be included within the pantheon of the relationship. I know that there are some, I once asked Don Jose, my teacher in Peru, I said, how would they have found this medicine out of, you know, two plants out of like a vast, you know, like there's thousands of plants, if not, you know, tens of thousands that are possible within that combination in the jungle. And to do it by trial and error would simply just beggars belief or even credibility.
It's not possible.
So he said that what probably likely happened, and I think it's a very credible idea, is that a person would have drunk the ayahuasca plant, because ayahuasca by itself in high concentrations is is also it can give you visions just without, just by itself. It's not as distinct or dramatic as when you add the psychotry viridis, but you can actually get direction. And the ayahuasca is the one that is the teacher. Really, the DMT brings the light. It's the feminine aspect of the alchemical marriage between the vine, which is seen as the forcer, the one who contains the force and the direction, the link to the earth, and the DMT or the psychotry viridis is connected to the galaxy. It's more galactic. It's more hyperspatial. It's more like it brings the light. It shows form and color and it shows. But ayahuasca, you feel and you have insights and you know things. So I'm sure that, according to him, he said that somebody would have drunk this Banisteroptos carpi, and in that vision, it would have shown the man or the shaman, this is the plant you need to look for. Go in the jungle and get this plant. And I'm sure that's a very credible idea, because when I was doing my three-month dieta here on the Terence McKenna brew, which, by the way, still stands as the most Rolls-Royce brew I've ever had. I was so fortunate to be weaned on that brew, which, honestly, I didn't realize at the time how fortunate I was until I started to drink other brews. And I realized, my God, they were all weak brews. This was so good.
Did you save any of it?
And so fortunately, I do have a bottle left, because I was doing a session in Texas, in that city. What's the kind of new age city in Texas?
Austin.
Austin, yeah, some years ago. And this old friend of Terence McKenna came to my session, and he gave me that as a present. And it was it was like getting a vintage bottle of wine, you know, because I didn't have any left out of my own supply. And he gave it to me, and even the top was all a bit moldy, but it was perfectly good. But it was already about 30 years old, you know. So I haven't even opened that yet, because it's like vintage. And one day I will. But my own brew now, I'd say, is as good as Terry, because I've had his to model mine on. So it does open up, it guides, and it also surprises you, because after those initial very powerful and dramatic downloads that I had in that three-month dieta, where I was basically being taught, then when I was holding sessions after that, I wasn't getting those big three-dimensional holographic downloads. I was just in a very clear space, able to hold space, being present for whoever is in the circle, and the medicine opened up in a new way for me. It actually felt I was super present. And that was really amazing to discover that there was this phase. And then that phase went on for quite some time. And then occasionally I'd get what I call a visitation, and I'd have to pay close attention because it was a teaching event again. But it opens up in different ways. And that's why I say you're dealing with a sentient awareness, and you're dealing with a teacher, in the sense that it will open up in a certain way for a period of time, then it'll open up in a different way according to what your development is and according to how your relationship with her is unfolding. And so there were even points where I thought, well, is this it? Is it never going to change again? Now I know what it's all about. That's one of those moments where I thought, oh, now I've got this pegged. And as soon as I thought that, it would change again. It would open up in some mysterious way and show me that I would know nothing. And I know nothing, you know, and it would be a humbling experience again and again where I go, I think I've got a handle on this. But what you're doing is you're opening up. It's not that ayahuasca is an entity. It's more accurate to say that you're dealing with an ecology of souls. You're dealing with an ecology of souls, which is like a group mind that can be multidimensional in the ways that it can express or teach or download. And every time I think that I've predict or peg what's happening, she shows me that it's not at all. And so I've kept a completely open-ended thing. Even at times I thought, oh, I'm getting the same thing all the time here, I don't make that mistake anymore. I just go, okay, this is what's happening. This is how the teacher is responding to me now. And I'm much more humble these days. I don't demand or insist or ask for or even, you know, I just accept. Because she's taught me how to be with her. And the thing is that it's like having a cosmic coordinator. You, like, nowadays I don't plan anything in my life anymore, and I haven't since the time of I started working with her 28 years ago. I used to, you know, plan things in future and plan my life here and there, but basically now all I do is ask for the next step, of whatever my next part of the journey is, and I do that to the best of my ability, and then I ask for the next step. And then I ask for the next step. Because once I saw where this medicine was going, she showed me in one of those downloads, in that 3-month download, where this was going, and that it would, she was coming to facilitate a major shift of consciousness in the human family. And once I saw that, and she gave me a finite experience of what that shift in consciousness is going to be like. It was actually an experience of a unified field. It was a state of oneness, a state of where everything is perfect, just as it is. And it was a state of bliss. And it was a state of like, nothing needs to be added. Everything is absolutely perfect, just as it is. It was so satisfying, so fulfilling. I felt so connected. There was no sense of any alienation. It was absolutely connected, knowing that you are part of the whole and you are the whole. I am it, it is I, that kind of an experience. Then I went, okay, if that's where you're going, if that's where you're leading us all, I'm in. My hands, this body, mind, these boots, I'm in, boots and all.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Salish Wolf with Darpan. If you want to learn more about Darpan and his vision for a better world, listen to the upcoming second installment of this podcast. And also check out his website, darpan.com. That's darpan.com. You can also follow him on Instagram at dar_pan369. Please check out anchorpointexpeditions.com for information on my men's leadership retreats and personal development coaching. Stay tuned for the announcement of 2021 retreats, during which I take men on purpose-driven adventures along British Columbia's Wild Coast. My next bow carving retreats are taking shape as early as September of this year. This show was produced by me, Todd Howard, on Vancouver Island. Music was written and performed by Jason Kaus of the Darcys. Special thanks to Pacific Rim College for their ongoing contribution to the show. For episodes on holistic health and sustainability, please tune into my other podcast, Pacific Rim College Radio, at pacificrimcollege.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give it a 5-star rating on whatever podcast app you are using and share it with your friends and family. Stay tuned for my upcoming Dogcast, Takea Chronicles, featuring the inspirational story of the lone wolf that mesmerized the city of Victoria by taking up residence on a tiny archipelago off the city's coastline. There, Takea thrived, showing us even the most unlikely is possible. You have been listening to Salish Wolf. I am Todd Howard, signing off.